Welcome to the Number 10 Podcast. Episode 6, The Glorious Revolution. I hope you're all well and enjoying the great summer weather we're having. I was interestingly having a look at temperature statistics over the last few hundred years, as you do, and it's interesting that the temperature as we record today is 26 degrees Celsius, compared to the average temperature for August in 1688, which was 15.3 degrees Celsius. And that's a very different summer compared to what we're having today. This was partly down to what was known as the Little Ice Age that occurred from around the 13th century to the early 19th century. Maybe it's global warming, but you'll have to go to a different podcast for an opinion on that. Before I start, I just wanted to thank everyone for their support with a recent problem I had with a podcast promoter who dumped a load of bad reviews on the Apple Podcasts page. Your support in leaving reviews has been tremendous, and I'm really grateful. Apple have actually now removed the bad reviews, and I'm really grateful to them as well as their quick support in getting it rectified. So thank you very much to Cindy and Adam over at the podcast team for that. The new podcast categories are live on Apple Podcasts, and we have now reselected these as our former category was deleted, and you can now find us on history, politics, or government. I'm really excited about today's episode because today we talk about the penultimate Stuart monarchy in the UK and what some say is the last successful invasion of the British Isles. If you remember, we spent some time talking about Charles II a few episodes back, who had become increasingly unpopular during his reign, with plots, assassinations, and a rowdy parliament being a thorn in his side. James had also become increasingly unpopular through Charles's reign, but Charles was now dead, and James was still unpopular, and now king as well. Although we spent quite a bit of time on James's reign last week, we're going to be focusing this episode on the last year of his reign. Now, the problem that James II faced was that he was a Catholic zealot and a political reformer, where if he had just been a Catholic reformer, he would have found some support in the Tories' camp and likewise with the Whigs with the political reform. What he found was that he ruled with little support by the time we get to 1688. Unlike his brother, the late King Charles II, James used his vast patronage to reward those who supported him and punished those who dissented. He started with a Tory stronghold that had existed since the exclusion crisis and filled the government exclusively with Tories. When they showed reluctance a few years into his reign, he purged them and replaced them with Whigs and Catholics. It showed that the king could pretty much do whatever he wanted. James's policies had alienated every single political segment of the nation. Sir James controlled the nation by packing institutions with friends and allies. In the words of Mark Kishlansky, historian, he found Anglican judges to uphold his power, bishops to cast a blind eye on Catholic worship, and magistrates to prosecute his foes. Towards the mid-1680s, James began to impose his will and beliefs in reform. Not only this, but he tried to put down any negative talk of the regime. Not being a fan of Parliament who didn't approve the reforms, James prorogued them or shut them down in November 1685. Guy Fawkes Night was also banned, as too were fireworks and bonfires, in a hope that there wouldn't be a repeat of the Pope burnings of earlier years. Many placed candles in their windows as a protest against Catholicism. Overall, there were 3,000 changes that James introduced, including those in the areas of religion, the military, education and judiciary from 1685 to 1688. James allowed Catholic seminaries to be built in London and accepted a diplomat from Rome to his court, the first one since Mary I over 100 years ago. James used presses to distribute Catholic literature across the country, which we see more from this point on as an effective form of propaganda. Not because it was new. I mean, William Caxton had introduced the printing press to England in 1476, but mainly as more people could read, although around 60% of the population were still illiterate. Anglican priests were censored for speaking anti-Catholic rhetoric in their pulpits and would face punishments if they were caught. Louis XIV had finally taken to driving out the Protestant Huguenots in 1685, so the stories of arbitrary Catholic government were reaching England yet again. In 1686, James sent away many of his advisers and appointed four Catholics to his Privy Council. Important figures, including James's brother-in-law, the Earls of Rochester and Clarendon, were dismissed. However, instead of kicking up a fuss, they went home and lived their private lives peacefully. This is important because no one in high office with the means and clout to topple James did so. Potentially as they saw the failings of Argyll and Monmouth, or maybe because they thought it was already a done deal. England was now a Catholic absolutist monarchy. Historian Mark Kishlansky again. Now James determined to put out the thousands of Anglicans from the military, the Commission of the Peace and the urban corporations. London was stripped of prominent Anglican aldermen, militia captains and members of livery companies. This was important, as James thought the only way he could achieve a cooperative parliament was to gain control of the urban electorate. James sent out his Lord Lieutenants, who themselves had been purged heavily, to carry out a poll of justices of the peace, deputy lieutenants, corporation office holders, members of livery companies and officials, and asked them three questions. 1. Would they support the repeal of penal laws, and especially the Test Acts? 2. Would they help secure the return of MPs who would support the repeals? And 3. Would they embrace the indulgence and live in peace with other religious groups? The results were a bit embarrassing to James. 27% of the Justices of the Peace said they wouldn't repeal. Another 27% said they would, and about 28% expressed doubt or reservation, with the final 18% unable to be found when the poll was being carried out. A vast number of business leaders were ousted, and elected officials were scooped out of office, and Catholic sympathisers were put in their positions. In 1687, 17 masters, 58 wardens, 79 assistants, and 1,795 liverymen were dismissed in London, and James's non-conformist cronies were installed. It didn't work massively well, as he did have to purge again the next year with a further 328 members of the companies in order to gain support. It wasn't a success even then. When James issued the first Declaration of Indulgence in 1687, only 19 city livery companies sent an address of thanks, compared to the 84 that delivered congratulations when James came to the throne. Just a reminder that the Declaration of Indulgence was a proclamation by James that tried to extend religious liberties to Catholics and nonconformists. One of the big areas that James got involved in was education. He thought it unfair that Catholics were excluded from public schools and universities, and that by introducing Catholics into the schools in management positions, it would draw out secret Catholics from the shadows, allowing them to worship freely. In 1687, a Catholic master was installed at Magdalen College, Cambridge, much to the dismay of many teachers there, who were in turn forcibly removed and friendlier alternatives were put in their place. Four Catholic convert scholars at Oxford were also given an exemption and were allowed to continue studying instead of having to resign their posts. James appointed Joshua Bassett, a Catholic convert, as master of Sidney Sussex College, Cambridge, in probably the most controversial move. It was within the king's gift to appoint masters and deans, however there was an ancient statute that this particular college always chose their own master, usually a Protestant, due to their constitution as a college. James said it had already been chosen and he wouldn't reverse the decision. There was a lot of protest as the fellows refused to admit Bassett, but after a visit to the Ecclesiastical Commission, they eventually backed down and James won. When Catholic Mass began being said in the chapels of these colleges, the local populace and even the Catholic fellows' students would turn up outside and try to disrupt the service with screams and shouts, showing it wasn't a popular move by any stretch. James also appointed a Catholic Earl to look after Ireland, although the Earl actually ended up being the deputy as a compromise, leaving the Lord role vacant, and started in his role by replacing every Irish Protestant sheriff. Fewer than 500 Protestants remained in the army by 1686. This was largely down to James's flaunting of the Test Act that required anyone holding a public office to essentially denounce Catholic teachings. We mentioned last time that James appointed Catholic generals to the army as well, but not only were its members changing, the army itself was also growing, much to the dismay of the Protestant population. Between 1685 and 1688, the three British armies, as they were still separated by nation at this time, increased in size fourfold, not surprisingly after the rebellions early in James's reign. As we said, the spark to the gunpowder was the birth of the Prince of Wales. It ended the "let's just wait it out" strategy of the monarch's opponents. James's son, also James, was born on the 10th of June 1688 at St. James's Palace and came as a surprise to the nation. James's wife, Mary of Medina, had not conceived for 5 years, and it was pretty much thought that Mary, James's Protestant daughter, would take over when he died. The fact that there was now a Catholic heir to the throne, and males still took precedence over their female siblings, terrified the Protestant population. The movement grew from then to cause a change to the line of succession. On the 30th of June, 1688, William of Orange received a letter in the Netherlands from seven Englishmen asking him to intervene with the Catholicisation of England and restore a Protestant reign. These seven men were the Earl of Shrewsbury, the Earl of Devonshire, the Earl of Danby, Lord Lumley, Bishop Henry Compton, Edward Russell, and Henry Sidney, whom actually wrote the letter himself. Quoting Tim Harris and the letter itself, the seven men assured William that the people were so generally dissatisfied with the present conduct of the government that 19 parts of 20 throughout the kingdom desired a change and would willingly contribute to it if they had such protection to countenance their rising as would secure them from being destroyed. It was no less certain, the letter continued, that much other great parts of the nobility and gentry were as much dissatisfied, and that some of the most considerable of them would join William at his landing and use their interest to draw great numbers to them. If William landed with a force sufficient to defend itself and them till they could be together in some order, they would soon have double the number of James's army, which they predicted would not remain loyal to the king in any case, since the officers and the common soldier were so discontented. These men became known as the Immortal Seven, and represented a number of groups that William would need to gain a broad consensus and approval from. Danby and Devonshire owned vast swathes of land and had geographical spheres of influence. Compton, as Bishop of London, represented the church. Shrewsbury and Lumley had been army officers, and Edward Russell represented the navy. Five were members of the House of Lords, but let's look at them in a bit more detail and also at their motivations. Charles Talbot, the Earl of Shrewsbury, was a Tory Protestant and had served in the army under James II. Richard Lumley, or Lord Lumley to his friends, had been a Catholic and was escorted on his grand tour by a Catholic priest, but converted to Protestantism in around 1685. He had risen up through the nobility titles under Charles, and even accompanied James on a trip to Morocco in 1680. He was heavily involved in the military campaign to put down the Duke of Monmouth, and supposedly the one who arrested him. Both Lumley and Shrewsbury had been removed from the army for their opposition to the entry of Catholic officers into the armed forces. William Cavendish, Earl of Devonshire, was also a Protestant Whig, who had led the anti-Catholic group in Parliament before the Whigs established themselves. Cavendish had opposed the arbitrary rule of James from his seat in the House of Lords and had found himself briefly imprisoned for failing to pay a £30,000 fine for hitting someone. It has been said that this was a setup in order to neutralise him and pull him out of a role where he could criticise James. You may remember last episode we left the Earl of Danby in the Tower of London after being accused of abusing his royal powers for his own gain. When James rose to the throne, he had Danby released, and the Earl then took up his seat in the House of Lords as the leader of a Tory group of Lords. Danby's opposition to James seems to have come from his attacks on the Church of England. Henry Compton, the Bishop of London, was an ardent anti-Catholic. he lost his position as Dean of the Chapel Royal for refusing to suspend a priest for his anti-papal preaching in the pulpit. He then found himself suspended by James's Ecclesiastical Court of High Commission for around 3 years from 1685. Edward Russell was a Whig Royal Navy officer and had served as an officer in the Third Anglo-Dutch War and in campaigns against Barbary corsairs in the Mediterranean. Russell was fired from public life in 1683, along with all other members of the Russell family, after his half-brother, Lord William Russell, was executed for supposed involvement in the Rye House plot. Henry Sidney was a Whig politician who saw his brother, Algernon, executed at the hands of Charles II after being implicated in the Rye House plot. His sister, Dorothy, died soon after, supposedly from the grief of losing Algernon. It might not be the only reason he was involved, but it's a pretty compelling start. As an agent of Robert Spencer, the Earl of Sunderland, it looks as if a lot of this was organised or encouraged by the patron. Sidney was given orders to negotiate with William in 1688 by Sunderland. Sunderland had been a key advisor to Charles and James and was forced to flee to the Netherlands after he was dismissed by James from service. Sunderland went on to advise William in what is about to come. Now, there's a lot of information to take in there, but there are recurring themes across these people. They were all against James's arbitrary rule, but more importantly, many of them were being or had been squeezed out of political or religious positions of authority and wanted to see their return. They came from Tories and Whigs, and it makes you think whether this wasn't just for the good of the Protestant England, but also for their own personal gain. Philosophers John Locke and Thomas Hobbes both point out humanity's capacity for selfishness, and maybe this is what's at play here. Talking about selfishness, we're going to take a quick break to plug my podcast and how you can make it even better. I love hearing from you, so please do get in touch on Facebook, just search Number 10 Podcast, or on Twitter, which is Number 10 Podcast, or you can email me at chris@notenpo.com. And you can also visit the website for more info and blogs, which I do alongside the episodes. If you have enjoyed, please follow or subscribe on whatever platform you're listening to. And if you're feeling really kind, please head to iTunes and leave me a review. The best thing you can do for me is just tell someone about the podcast, send a link to a friend. I'd love to share this with as many people as possible. So if you can help, thank you. Now we move across the sea and look at William of Orange. This is a little confusing as there's quite a few Williams and a whole lot of Orange. I may have made it seem in the last episode that William married Mary, the daughter of King Charles II, and here's the one that the letter is written to. This isn't the case. William II married Mary, the daughter of King Charles I, in 1641, and they had William III of Orange, who was also married to an English princess called Mary, the eldest daughter of Charles II. Sometimes when I research this, I long for a Queen Becky or a King Tony, just to break up the same five royal names in monotonous circulated use. Sir William had been stadtholder of a collection of provinces east of France known as the Dutch Republic, which was not the equivalent of king in England. It was the office of steward, and had been born out of the Middle Ages, where feudal lords would appoint stadtholders to represent them, almost like managers. Into the 1600s, each province continued to elect stadtholders to speak for them, although the province of Holland, Zeeland and Utrecht was the most important, as it also controlled the Confederate army and navy, and was thus seen very much as the head of the country. William had been the national leader for almost 20 years by 1688, and had spent much of his reign in wars against Louis XIV of France. At one point, he was fighting both the English and the French at the same time, but managed to sue for peace by 1678, although this was at the price of some of William's territory, including the city of Nijmegen. France had also gained some of the land from the Spanish Netherlands that sat as a buffer between the Dutch Republic and France. We'll come back to French relations again once we've got this invasion out of the way. William had been plotting long before the news of the Queen's pregnancy or the birth of the Prince of Wales. He'd also asked Danby, Shrewsbury and a few others for an invitation early in June, and they were willing to supply it. Although William had a lot of intel on what was going on in England, it wasn't until late September of 1688 that James discovered that the Dutch were making military preparations to invade. He tried to dissuade this through political means. After a meeting with Anglican bishops who laid out a list of demands to get them back on side, James listened in full. Without delay, he reversed the policies that had brought the Whigs and Catholics to strength. He banned Catholics from entering the upcoming parliamentary session and then 2 weeks later cancelled the session altogether. William Compton found himself back as Bishop of London, and various hated religious organisations were disbanded, as well as making a pledge that he would inviolably preserve the Church of England. A number of university fellows who had been dismissed when Catholic masters were appointed also saw themselves reinstated. Many dismissed judges were reappointed, and some Catholics who had recently been appointed were let go. Through the legal process of quo warranto, James had caused havoc with town corporations by enforcing new charters on them and disavowing them of their ancient town and city rights. These were all reversed, and many Tory mayors, army officers, and public servants returned to office. James also issued a declaration of neutrality to the Dutch Republic in a clever attempt at propaganda to make any invasion look like a display of warmongering. William, in a just as clever propaganda move, wrote back stating that all he was going to do was come over, inquire into the status of political, religious and civil liberties, and make sure that they weren't being harmed. He also hinted as to the illegitimacy of the newly born Prince of Wales, that he had been sneaked into the Queen's bedchamber in a bed-warming pan. 2 months after James had realised William's intention, William landed at Brixham on England's southern coast, close to the town of Torquay, in an area we would call today the English Riviera. It was quite an army, 15,000 to 20,000 soldiers, 5,000 cavalry, 21 cannons, 500 working animals, and 20,000 additional weapons disembarked from a flotilla of 500 ships. There had been an attempt to leave in October, but a brutal storm on the Dutch coast forced the fleet back. When they set off again in November, the fleet headed north towards Essex, and as the wind began to change, they changed their course west towards the English Riviera. There is a famous term coined for the fact that William's fleet was twice spotted by the substantially smaller British fleet, but was unharassed, known as the Protestant Wind. This blew the fleet almost miraculously to the Torbay area without issue, with the wind being so unfavourable to James's fleet that they could not pursue. Now, James believed that William would land close to London, and for this reason garrisoned most of his troops there. As William marched towards London, he encountered little resistance exactly for this reason. James had refused the offer of French soldiers from Louis XIV, as he knew it would hurt his position, but ended up mustering around 19,000 soldiers himself, although there was a huge lack of morale among the troops and a supposed conspiracy amongst the officers. It was not a foregone conclusion that William would be successful. James's army was bigger, fighting on home ground, and as far as military records go, his was very good. He'd shown himself to be a competent and calculating tactician. The key factor as to why the army broke apart was the majority of senior officers defected to William. Lord Cornbury and his dragoons were the first unit to encounter the invading army, and after a small skirmish, he defected to William with many of his dragoons. When James heard the news of the officers retreating, he pulled his army back from Salisbury, where it was encamped. 4 days later, there was another defection. John Churchill, who had played a leading role in the putting down of the Monmouth Rebellion, especially for his role in the Battle of Sedgemoor. As he didn't have a political rank at the time, he did not sign the letter sent to William, but was going to desert at the right moment. That came on the 24th November, when he left the royal camp with 400 soldiers and officers, leaving behind a note saying, "I hope the great advantage I enjoy under your majesty, which I own would never expect in any other change of government, may reasonably convince your majesty and the world that I am actuated by a higher principle." Churchill had been a loyal and effective officer, and it had shaken James that not even Churchill was to remain loyal to him, that there was going to be some serious issues moving forward. What's more, Churchill's wife had been very influential in obtaining another desertion, that of James's younger daughter, Princess Anne. James returned to London after the tragic news, leaving Feversham in charge of the royal forces. William took Plymouth, Sherborne, Hindon, and Salisbury in a matter of 3 weeks, and met with royal negotiators in Hungerford, which, if you're a frequenter of the M4 motorway, is now Junction 14, negotiating with them on around the 7th of December. James offered free elections and a general amnesty, although what he really was doing was playing for time, as he had already decided that he was going to flee, convinced that he would be executed if caught. On the 8th of December, William actually agreed to the terms that James set forward, but wanted to add that all Catholics were removed from office immediately across the land. Surprisingly, there was no reply received, because on the night of the 10th of December, James threw the Great Seal into the Thames, which is required to summon lawful parliamentary sessions, and headed for France. William wanted him to escape and leave the country, although on the first attempt he was caught by sailors who mistook him for a Jesuit missionary. I mean, I suppose he was one in some senses. The first blood drawn in mid-November was at Wincanton, where an advanced Scottish Guard unit of around 30 troops was ambushed by around 120 royal troops, killing a dozen Scots and taking around the same again as prisoners. This was one of the two battles of the Glorious Revolution, the other one being the Battle of Reading on the 9th of December. James had stationed 600 Irish soldiers in Reading as an advanced guard. The inhabitants thought that they were about to be massacred, so after hearing this from an inhabitant, William sent 250 Dutch veterans to assist. With knowledge from residents, the veterans attacked from favourable positions and were supported by residents shooting from windows. The Irish force fled after losing a few dozen men and the Dutch losing almost none. There was a large outpouring of hysteria about Irish troops across the UK, contributing to something known as the Irish Fright. Around 2,500 Irish soldiers were brought over to protect England from William's invasion, many of whom were garrisoned in Portsmouth. As early as October, there were reports of the Irish committing robberies throughout the city. On the 13th of December, news was brought to London by Bishop Gilbert Burnet that the Irish were advancing on London with a view to putting all before them to fire and sword. This, coupled with false reports that the town of Uxbridge had been looted, brought a purported 100,000 people to the street, ready to protect their city. Around 20 counties were affected by the Irish Fright, started by rumours but bringing a mass hysteria and armed mobs together to fight the apparent threat. The Irish soldiers only really saw one battle, that of the Battle of Reading, in the Glorious Revolution conflict. By the time William made it to where James was stationed with his Royal Army, near Uxbridge, it had disbanded and gone home. I think part of this is because the army realised that they would have armed militias in every town that they passed, thinking that the Catholic Irish were going to loot and murder them. So as the chance of a great conflict faded away, James was arrested by his own choice and left lightly guarded in a palace in Rochester. Dutch officers were told to let him slip away if he wanted to, which he did, and managed to make it to France on ships waiting for him, arriving early on Christmas morning with the greatest gift he'd ever had, his head still attached to his shoulders. Mary of Medina, James's wife, and the young Prince of Wales escaped in the midst of the revolution disguised as a washerwoman and spent the next 2 decades at the Chateau de Saint-Germain-en-Laye. We'll be seeing the young prince again very soon. As James was taken to Rochester, William entered London on the 18th December. He entered to rapturous applause despite dreadful weather, carrying a banner in Latin that read, Nolimus leges angelae mutare, meaning, we are unwilling to change the laws of England. It's unclear whether William meant to seize the throne. We know that it started out as a way of successfully securing landing points for a further invasion of France, as war was inevitable again with the Catholic powerhouse. This could have been accomplished without taking over, merely controlling ports or a segment of the country, which could have been achieved through a treaty or negotiation with James in exchange for his retaining the throne. We know that he wasn't invited to become king. The Tories would not have supported his arrival if that was the case, though they didn't see the end result coming. They could not justify the invasion, but knew if it hadn't have happened, there was a sad path ahead of them. The Whigs were also torn in what they wanted. Some wanted a proper constitutional parliamentary democracy, and others just wanted to make sure a Protestant sat on the throne. You may ask why it was called the Glorious Revolution. Let me give you some context of other revolutions that have happened around the world. 37,234 were killed in the American Revolutionary War and 620,000 in the ensuing Civil War. Some estimates of up to 2 million people killed in the Mexican Revolution. The English Civil War saw around 200,000 dead in combat and war-related diseases. Roughly a quarter of a million people were killed in the French Revolutionary War battles, but that's not including another 40,000 who went to meet Madame Guillotine. The Glorious Revolution, you ask? Around 80 people killed. That's why it was glorious. William now had to find a way of filling the massive power vacuum that had been created by the revolution. He had to convince Parliament, corporations, the church, the military, and a number of different stakeholders that this was a good idea for England. He needed to appeal to everyone and achieve a consensus that hadn't ever really been seen before. James had fled and was building an army in Ireland, which, if William didn't deal with it, could depose him with an invasion. Lots to do in December 1688, and it's going to be a busy Christmas for William and his wife Mary on the next episode of the Number 10 podcast. Till next time, goodbye.